gotten off the ground in the first place. Signaling an hirer's remorse, Becker's critique also naively assumes that employers automatically dismiss any worker who falls short of expectations. Labor regulations and lawsuits aside, firms are not run by robots. When humans work side by side, they develop fraternal feelings for one another. As long as their business is not in jeopardy, many employers retain moderately subpar employees indefinitely. And even if the boss is bereft of empathy, most of their employees won't be. Disgruntled workers are less productive workers. Any boss who deprives someone of their livelihood has to fear the blow to remaining workers' morale. Give people a chance. Observe how they do. Fire them if they don't measure up. A hire-look flush personnel policy sounds both profitable and fair. Yet group identity and pity get in the way. After a firm hires you, you're part of the team. If you don't measure up, firing you isn't like returning a blender to Walmart. Your teammates either have to live with your poor performance or feel sorry to see you go. Employers do have one guilt-free way to reverse a bad hiring decision. Human resources calls it dehiring. Instead of firing the unwanted worker, help them jump ship. Privately urge them to find new opportunities. When firms call for a reference, shade the truth or lie. Labor law punishes firms that reveal negative information about their personnel, yet the law merely reinforces social psychology. As soon as the unwanted worker leaves for their new job, their co-workers and boss can stop feeling sorry for the departed and start feeling happy for themselves. Everyone wins, except the next firm. The more firms fear to fire, the more educational signaling matters. Once employers get hirers' remorse, they're stuck in an awkward position. Relying on credentials is a good way to avoid getting stuck in the first place. A strong academic record tells employers, "I'm not going to make you choose between feeling like a sucker and feeling like a heel." Employers who ignore the uncredentialed may seem narrow-minded, but they hire with peace of mind. The lesson? Strong educational signals durably help your career, employer learning notwithstanding. In the real world, Harvard degrees pay off handsomely because Harvard grads are great workers. Imagine, however, that you have the world's only perfectly forged Harvard diploma. With any luck, you'll ride the Harvard gravy train for years. Your fake diploma lands you a sweet job. By the time your boss sees your flaws, some of your co-workers will be your friends. Maybe the boss retains you out of pity or to avoid a blow to morale. If and when the boss's patience runs out, they probably won't blatantly fire you. Instead, they'll nudge you to find a better match. When potential employers check up on you, your current employer has every reason to cover for you, allowing you to reboot your saga of deception and disappointment. Riddle me this. Higher education is the only product where the consumer tries to get as little out of it as possible. Arnold Kling, College Customers versus Suppliers. Critics of the signaling model are quick to insist that signaling simply doesn't make sense. The truth is the opposite. Human capital purism is what simply doesn't make sense. Some big blatant facts are inexplicable without the signaling model. The best education in the world is already free. All complaints about elite colleges, impossible admissions, and insane tuition are flatly mistaken. Fact, anyone can study at Princeton for free. While tuition is over $45,000 a year, anyone can show up and start attending classes. No one will stop you. No one will challenge you. No one will make you feel unwelcome. Gorge yourself at Princeton's all-you-can-eat buffet of the mind. Colleges do not card. I have seen this with my own eyes at schools around the country. If you keep your learn-for-free scheme to yourself, professors will assume you're missing from their roster owing to a bureaucratic snafu. If you ask permission to sit in, most professors will be flattered. What a rare pleasure to teach someone who wants to learn. After 4 years of guerrilla education, there's only one thing you'll lack: a diploma. Since you're not in the system, your performance will be invisible to employers. Not too enticing, is it? Imagine this stark dilemma. You can either have a Princeton education without a diploma or a Princeton diploma without an education. Which gets you further on the job market? For a human capital purist, the answer is obvious. 4 years of training are vastly preferable to a page of paper. But try saying that with a straight face. Sensible versions of the signaling model don't imply the diploma is clearly preferable. After all, Princeton teaches some useful skills. But you need signaling to explain why choosing between an education and a diploma is a head-scratcher rather than a no-brainer. You could demur, there's far more to a Princeton education than the coursework. But if you're already attending Princeton's classes, why couldn't you also join its study groups, intellectual discussions, and social life? You won't live in the dorm, but as long as you make the extra effort, rich peer interaction is within your grasp. In any case, to the best of my knowledge, there's no evidence that residing in dormitories has any extra payoff in the labor market. Students usually see off-campus living as a luxury, not a threat to their career success. The main objection to the guerrilla education argument, though, is simply almost no one takes advantage of it. That's precisely my point. The fact that almost no one grabs a free elite education shows human capital purism is false. For the signaling model, in contrast, the freebie is mere illusion. Universities don't card because they don't need to. Unofficial education is vanishingly rare because it sends employers an invisible signal, also known as no signal at all. Failing versus forgetting. You've studied many subjects you barely remember. You might have motivated yourself with, after the final exam, I'll never have to think about this stupid subject again. Question: how would your career have been different if you flunked all the classes you've forgotten? If employers rewarded well-educated workers for skills alone, failing a class and forgetting a class would have identical career consequences. They plainly don't. Take me. After 3 years of Spanish homework, Spanish exams, and Spanish presentations, I remember nearly nada. Yet, if I had failed high school Spanish, I couldn't have gone to a good college, wouldn't have gotten into Princeton's PhD program, and probably wouldn't be a professor. Luckily, I learned enough to get A's on my report card. As a result, I'm living my dream, linguistic amnesia notwithstanding. Human capital purists have one way to cope with these facts. Claim studying a subject improves you in subtle ways long after you forget all your explicit lessons. Educational psychologists have spent a century measuring such subtle learning. We'll hear them out next chapter. For now, this story simply strains credulity. My Spanish teacher's official goal was to teach me Spanish. It was their native language. They failed. Are we really supposed to believe my Spanish teachers successfully taught me something that wasn't on their agenda? Something that's actually useful on the job? If my Spanish teachers couldn't achieve their official goal, despite their expertise, you'd have to be awfully gullible to believe they covertly taught me how to work. Yet they were no worse than most of my teachers, and in all likelihood, no worse than most of yours. Unlike human capital purism, signaling can explain these facts without torturing them first. Failing to learn course material sends a lousy signal. You were lacking in intelligence, conscientiousness, and/or conformity, and probably still are. Forgetting course material, on the other hand, merely signals you lack the superpower of photographic memory. Since failing students send a far more negative signal than forgetful students, employers favor the forgetful. Since failing students suffer far more in the job market than forgetful students, students cram for the final exam, then move on with their lives. Easy A's. Students struggle to win admission to elite schools. Once they arrive, however, they hunt for professors with low expectations. A professor who wants to fill a lecture hall hands out lots of A's and little homework. On the popular Rate My Professors website, students grade their professors' easiness, helpfulness, clarity, and hotness, not marketable skills taught or real-world relevance. If human capital purists are right, why do students struggle to get into the best schools, then struggle to avoid acquiring skills once they arrive? signaling to the rescue. Schools have national, even global reputations. Students and employers know the difference between Princeton and Podunk State. Most professors, in contrast, have only local reputations. George Mason students know I'm not an easy A. Their future employers don't. Anyone who likes money and dislikes studying has an obvious two-part strategy. Choose the best school that admits you so you get a good job after graduation, and choose the easiest professors on campus so you have a good time before graduation. Cheating. According to human capital purists, the labor market rewards only job skills, not academic credentials. Taken literally, this implies academic cheating is futile. Sure, a failing student can raise their grade by copying an A-plus exam or plagiarizing a term paper from the Internet. Unless copying and plagiarizing make people more productive for their employer, however, the human capital model implies zero financial payoff for the worker. Cheaters proverbially only cheat themselves. The human capital model doesn't just imply all cheaters are wasting their time, it also implies all educators who try to prevent cheating are wasting their time. All exams might as well be take-home. No one needs to proctor tests or call time. No one needs to punish plagiarism or Google random sentences to detect it. Learners get job skills and financial rewards. Fakers get poetic justice. Signaling, in contrast, explains why cheating pays and why schools are wise to combat it. In the signaling model, employers reward workers for the skills they think those workers possess. Cheating tricks employers into thinking you're a better worker than you really are. The trick pays because unless everyone cheats all the time, students with better records are, on average, better workers. Why discourage cheating? Because detecting and punishing cheaters preserve the signaling value of your school's diploma. When more of your students cheat their way to graduation, firms that hire your students are less likely to get the smart, hard-working team players they're paying for. Every time your school expels a cheater, you protect the good name of your graduates, past, present, and future. Even habitual cheaters abhor a diploma mill. You're free to slack, but on graduation day, the master of ceremonies hands you a worthless sheet of paper. Why do students rejoice when the teacher cancels class? Teachers have a foolproof way to make their students cheer, cancel class. If human capital purists are right, such jubilation is bizarre. Since you go to school to acquire job skills, a teacher who cancels class rips you off. You learn less, you're less employable, yet your school doesn't refund a dime of tuition. In construction, contractors don't jump for joy if their roofers skip shingling to go gambling. In school, however, students jump for joy if their teachers cancel class to attend a conference in Vegas. When students celebrate the absence of education, it's tempting to blame their myopia on immaturity. Tempting, but wrong-headed. Once they're in college, myopic, immature students can unilaterally skip class whenever they like. Why wait for the teacher's green light? For most students, there's an obvious answer. When you skip class, your relative performance suffers. When your teacher cancels class, everyone learns less, leaving your relative performance unimpaired. Human capital purists must reject this obvious answer. Employers reward you for your skills, not your skills compared to your classmates. Signaling, in contrast, takes the obvious answer over the finish line. Why do students cheer when a teacher cancels class? Because they've escaped an hour of drudgery without hurting their GPA. Why don't students unilaterally skip class? Because if they skip class and their classmates don't, their grades suffer. Why do students focus on grades rather than learning? Because they follow the money. Lead into gold. If you single-mindedly focus on graduates' paychecks, education turns lead into gold. Waiters walk in, economic consultants walk out. For teachers, it's so tempting to take credit, to gaze on our former students in their mortar boards and gloat, "I amaze even myself." If teachers were honest with ourselves, we would be slower to self-congratulate. Do we really transform waiters into economic consultants, or merely evaluate whether waiters have the right stuff to be economic consultants? By analogy, both sculptors and appraisers have the power to raise the market value of a piece of stone. The sculptor raises the market value of a piece of stone by shaping it. The appraiser raises the market value of a piece of stone by judging it. Teachers need to ask ourselves, how much of what we do is sculpting, and how much is appraising? And if we won't ask ourselves, our alumni need to ask for us. Chapter 2. The Puzzle is Real. The Ubiquity of Useless Education. He rambled on about how Rembrandt captured the soul state of each of his figures, and then he made an analogy to Beethoven's music. He extended the analogy for several minutes, not realizing that nobody in the class knew anything about Beethoven. 3 weeks into summer vacation, most students won't remember anything about Rembrandt. James Schneider, Flight into L.A. Highlighting the stark contrast between what students have to learn and what workers need to know throws us off balance. Many accept the signaling explanation and move on, yet others recover their footing and start asking troubling questions. Could education be more useful than it seems on the surface? Less lucrative than it seems on the surface? The signaling model solves a puzzle. Why does the labor market reward useless education? Yet perhaps we're getting ahead of ourselves. Before we solve this alleged puzzle, we must scrutinize precisely what students learn and what employers reward. Perhaps the magic of education can be dispelled. There are several common approaches. Educators' favorite, insisting that no matter what they study, students are learning how to learn or how to think. Laymen prefer stories about blood, sweat, and tears. Suffering in school teaches discipline or builds character. Self-made curmudgeons occasionally harumph that anyone smart and disciplined enough to succeed in school could have done as well by skipping college and starting their own business. My father, a Ph.D. in electrical engineering, routinely denied that soft majors pay. When I was growing up, he gave me the impression there were only two education career tracks. Some students study engineering to become engineers, the rest study liberal arts to become taxi drivers. Do any attempts to dispel the magic of education pass muster? If so, how successful are they? For clarity, I split the evidence into two chapters. The chapter at hand focuses on learning, the chapter to follow on earning. Can we reconcile the skills students acquire before graduation with the payoffs workers enjoy after graduation? After good hard looks at learning and earning, we'll know the true size of the puzzle. The content of the curriculum. You obviously learn some valuable skills in school. Engineering, computer science, signaling models. David Autor, Lecture Note 18. Every school teaches a mix of useful skills and filler of wheat and chaff. The crucial question is, what's today's mix? 90% wheat and 10% chaff? 50-50, 20-80? While we'll never perfectly measure the breakdown, the basic facts are a good place to start. High school. What do students actually study in grades 9 through 12? The Digest of Education Statistics shows high school grads completed coursework by subject. It's all useful in the trivial sense that it improves students' odds of high school graduation and college admission. But what about useful in the stronger sense that students eventually apply their lessons on the job? After breaking down the curriculum by subjects, I sort them into three categories of usefulness: high, medium, and low. High usefulness means knowledge of the subject improves job performance in a wide range of occupations. Most students in a class will eventually use what they learn. Medium usefulness means knowledge of the subject improves job performance in some common occupations. A few students in a class will eventually use what they learn. Low usefulness means knowledge of the subject at best improves job performance in rare occupations. Students are likely to apply what they learn only if they become teachers of the subject. These ratings are my personal judgments, drawing on 40 years in school. Fortunately, though, every reader has enough first-hand educational experience to make an independent expert judgment. If you question my rankings, please substitute your own. The basis for my breakdown. High usefulness. In a modern economy, literacy and numeracy are the only skills that almost all jobs require, so English and math make the cut. Why not science? The subject is highly useful for our society. However, only a handful of specialists apply their knowledge of science on the job. The rest of us merely follow their recipes. Medium usefulness. Career technical classes are potentially useful stepping stones for students who plan to enter a short list of trades like cooking, sewing, metalworking, woodworking, drafting, or computer programming. By themselves, though, high school level classes do not open career doors. Students who take a class in cooking, then stop, are not yet employable as cooks. High school science classes, similarly, are only stepping stones for the tiny share of students who pursue careers in science or engineering. How tiny? About one-third of high school graduates have a bachelor's degree. Only 14% of students who earn a bachelor's degree major in science or engineering. That multiplies out to roughly 5%. Low usefulness. To belabor the obvious, the arts are rarely useful. We don't speak of starving artists for nothing. The staunchest fans of painting, sculpture, and music know pursuing a career in the arts is a Hail Mary pass. Foreign languages, similarly, are all but useless in the American economy. Thanks to immigration, employers have a built-in pool of native speakers of almost every living language. The average American high school student nevertheless spends 2 full years sitting in Spanish, French, German, Italian, or even Latin. Physical education, the most recognizable form of personal use coursework, trains only a handful of budding professional athletes and the next generation of gym teachers. Finally, almost no one pursues a career in history or social studies, except teachers of history and social studies. An optimist might emphasize that over half of students' courses are useful to some degree, and nearly one-third are highly useful. The optimist should keep in mind that I grade usefulness on a curve. Even highly useful subjects are more academic and less practical than they sound. Take math. Almost every modern occupation uses some math, yet high schools teach and often require math rarely used outside a classroom. Geometry is the most common of all math courses, over four-fifths completed in high school, yet the subject, featuring countless proofs of triangles congruence, is notoriously irrelevant. Geometry rarely pops up after the final exam, even in other math classes. Algebra 1, which teaches students graphing and one and two variable equations, has many practical applications. Most students, however, continue on to Algebra 2, which largely exists to prepare students for calculus. Calculus, in turn, gets you into college. Once college begins, however, you'll probably never differentiate another equation unless you pursue a degree in math, science, or engineering. Knowledge of statistics, in contrast, is useful whether or not you go to college. Nobel Prize winner Daniel Kahneman shows that statistical illiteracy underpins many foolish real-world choices, yet only 7.7% of high school students pass a stats class. The point isn't that the current curricula of the American high school is silly by historic or world standards. The status quo is more practical than a classical education in Latin and Greek. The point, rather, is that American high school is far from the skill factory we often imagine it to be. Being more relevant than Oxford in 1750 is nothing to brag about. College. We can ballpark the practicality of higher education by looking at the distribution of majors. High usefulness? Defenders of the real-world relevance of education love to invoke engineering. Engineering students learn how to make stuff work. Employers hire them to make stuff work. Engineering has well-defined sub-branches, each with straightforward applications: electrical, mechanical, civil, nuclear. Before we get carried away, we should accept a key fact. Engineering is a challenging, hence unpopular, major. Psychologists outnumber engineers. Artists outnumber engineers. Social scientists plus historians outnumber engineers almost 2-1. What other majors deserve to be in engineering's august company? Let's grade leniently. As long as a major explicitly prepares students for well-defined technical careers, it's highly useful. By this forgiving standard, health professions and agriculture majors end up in the same boat as engineers, and the fraction of graduates who earn highly useful degrees remains under 25%. Medium usefulness. Majors like business, education, and public administration sound vaguely vocational and funnel students toward predictable occupations after graduation. At the same time, they teach few technical skills, and non-majors readily compete for the same jobs. While you could dismiss these majors as low in usefulness, let's give them the benefit of the doubt. You don't need a business degree to work in business, but perhaps your coursework gives you an edge. You don't need an education degree to land a teaching job, but explicitly studying education could enhance your teaching down the road. You don't need a degree in public administration to be a bureaucrat, but maybe such coursework builds a better bureaucrat. By this standard, about 35% of majors end up in the medium category. Why put math majors in the same box as students of education or parks and recreation? In a sense, no one acquires more technical skills than mathematicians. However, graduates in pure mathematics have no clear occupational track. Many employers hire them for their general quantitative ability. Outside of academia, however, no one pays you to prove theorems. Low usefulness. The status of most of the majors in this bin, fine arts, philosophy, women's studies, theology, and such, should be uncontroversial. Liberal arts programs uphold the ideal of knowledge for knowledge's sake. Few even pretend to prepare students for the job market. You could argue I underrate the usefulness of communications and psychology. Don't they prepare students to work in journalism and psychology? Yet this objection is almost as naive as, don't history programs prepare students to work as historians? Psychology, communications, and history's usefulness is low because they prepare their students for fields where paying jobs are almost impossible to get. In 2008-2009, over 94,000 students earned their bachelor's in psychology, but there are only 174,000 practicing psychologists in the country. In the same year, over 83,000 students earned their bachelor's degree in communications. Total jobs for reporters, correspondents, and broadcast news analysts number 54,000. Historians, unsurprisingly, have the bleakest prospects of all. There were over 34,000 newly minted history graduates and only 3,500 working historians in the entire country. The vast majority of students who earn these degrees find employment outside their field. There's no other way to balance the books. The staunchest defenders of education reject the idea of sorting subjects and majors by usefulness. How do you know Latin, trigonometry, or Emily Dickinson won't serve you on the job? A man told me his French once helped him understand an airport announcement in Paris. Without high school French, he would have missed his flight. Invest years now, and one day you may save hours at an airport. See? Studying French pays. These claims remind me of Hoarders, a reality show about people whose mad acquisitiveness has ruined their lives. Some hoarders collect herds of cats, others old refrigerators, others their own garbage. Why not throw away some of their useless possessions? Stock answer, I might need it one day. They might need 100 empty milk cartons. Taken literally, the hoarders are right. There is a chance they'll need their trash. The common sense reply is that packing your house with trash is almost always a bad idea. You must weigh the storage cost against the likely benefits. The same goes for knowledge. Yes, you might need Latin one day. Maybe a time machine will strand you in ancient Rome. Still, does it make sense to study a dead language for years to prepare for a scenario you almost certainly won't face? You cannot retreat to agnosticism. No one knows if this trash will come in handy is a crazy argument for hoarding trash. No one knows if this knowledge will come in handy is a crazy argument for hoarding knowledge. measured learning. For human capital purists, education pays only because students learn. Sitting in class year after year is not sufficient. Students must actually acquire knowledge. Given the size of the education premium, human capital purists ought to believe students acquire a lot of knowledge in school. That's not all. Human capital purists also ought to believe workers retain a lot of the knowledge they acquire in school. The labor market pays you for what you know now, not what you knew on graduation day. For human capital purists, the coexistence of a high education premium and low learning retention would be a puzzle. The less students know and remember, the greater the puzzle. For the signaling model, in contrast, the coexistence of a high education premium and low learning retention raises no eyebrows. While students could signal their intelligence, conscientiousness, and conformity by acquiring and retaining a vast stock of knowledge, they don't have to. Students can win employers' favor by learning enough to get a good grade, then forgetting every lesson. How much do schools teach students, and how much do students retain? Measurement is tricky. Using students' standardized test scores implicitly assumes students learn everything they know in school. What about changes in students' standardized test scores? A little better, but the basic problem remains. The fact that students improve from grade to grade does not show schooling caused their improvement. Maybe they're maturing or learning in their spare time. Given these doubts, most researchers strongly prefer controlled experiments. Randomly give some kids extra education, then measure their surplus knowledge. Unfortunately, all these approaches, controlled experiments included, neglect retention. Even if schooling indisputably raises students' scores, the gain could be fleeting. Teachers often lament summer learning loss. Students know less at the end of summer than they did at the beginning. But summer learning loss is only a special case of the problem of fade-out. Human beings poorly retain knowledge they rarely use. Researchers are especially prone to neglect post-graduation fade-out. They measure how quickly fourth graders forget third grade, but not how quickly high school graduates forget 12th grade. A rare and discouraging exception. One major study tested roughly 1,000 people's knowledge of algebra and geometry. Some participants were still in high school. The rest were adults between 19 and 84 years old. The researchers had data on subjects' full mathematical education. Main finding, most people who take high school algebra and geometry forget about half of what they learn within 5 years and forget almost everything within 25 years. Only people who continue on to calculus retain most of their algebra and geometry. Is long-term retention really this weak? Despite the shortage of long-term retention studies, we can fall back on a compelling shortcut. Instead of measuring the enduring effect of education on adult knowledge, we can place an upper bound on that effect. It's a two-step process. Step one, measure adult knowledge about various school subjects. Step two, note that schools can't be responsible for more than 100% of what adults know about these subjects. What people now know is therefore an upper bound on the school learning they retain. My shortcut is easy to implement. Surveys of adults' knowledge of reading, math, history, civics, science, and foreign languages are already on the shelf. The results are stark. Basic literacy and numeracy are virtually the only book learning most American adults possess. While the average American spends years and years studying other subjects, they recall next to nothing about them. If schools teach us everything we know about history, civics, science, and foreign languages, their achievement is pitiful. Literacy and numeracy. In 2003, the United States Department of Education gave about 18,000 randomly selected Americans the National Assessment of Adult Literacy, NAAL. The NAAL tested prose literacy, knowledge and skills needed to search, comprehend, and use information from continuous texts. Document literacy, knowledge and skills needed to search, comprehend, and use information from non-continuous texts. And quantitative literacy, knowledge and skills needed to identify and perform computations using numbers that are embedded in printed materials. For each of these three subtests, the NAAL charitably grades respondents' knowledge as below basic, basic, intermediate, or proficient. Summing two prices and finding a table in an almanac are basic, not below basic, tasks. Given these low standards, you might think that virtually all Americans would score at the intermediate or proficient level in every subject. Not even close. The ignorance revealed by the NAAL is numbing. Only modest majorities are intermediate or proficient on the prose and document tests. Under half are intermediate or proficient on the quantitative test. Reviewing specific questions underscores the severity of the ignorance. Barely half know that saving 5 cents per gallon on 140 gallons of oil equals $7. 35% of Americans can't correctly enter a name and address on a certified mail form, with no points off for misspelling. Schools do far less to cure illiteracy and innumeracy than we'd like to think. Still, illiterate and innumerate compared to what is a fair response? Conceivably, in the absence of English and math courses, all Americans would be below basic in all three categories. From this perspective, the NAAL puts a fairly high upper bound on schools' total effect on Americans' literacy and numeracy. 86% of Americans exceed below basic for prose, 88% exceed below basic for documents, 78% exceed below basic for quantitative. For each of the three categories, 13% are actually proficient. While these results are meager given the typical American student's years in English and math, they're way better than nothing from employers' point of view. How do the NAAL results look if you break them down by education? If you mentally picture high school graduates, you probably see them as intermediate or proficient in literacy and numeracy. If you mentally picture college students, you probably see them as proficient in literacy and numeracy. Such mental pictures do not fit the facts. While today's dropouts almost always spend at least 9 years in school, over half remain functionally illiterate and innumerate. Over half of high school grads have less than the minimum skills one would naively expect them to possess, though college grads spend at least 17 years in school. Under a third have the level of literacy and numeracy we assume of every college freshman. History and civics. What does the average American learn in school besides basic literacy and numeracy? Precisely how much of our knowledge of history, civics, science, and foreign languages do we owe to education? Once again, we can use surveys of adult knowledge to put a ceiling on the answer. Starting with history and civics, all national surveys find severe ignorance. The American Revolution Center tested 1,001 adult Americans' knowledge of the American Revolution. 83% earned failing grades. The Intercollegiate Studies Institute tested over 2,500 adult Americans' knowledge of American government and American history. 71% earned failing grades. Newsweek magazine gave 1,000 Americans the U.S. citizenship test. 38% scored too low to become citizens of their own country. On the 2000 American National Elections study, the typical person got 48% of the factual questions right. You would expect 28% by guessing. These results are consistent with a vast academic literature on Americans' lack of political knowledge. You could blame low scores on the difficulty of the tests rather than the ignorance of the test takers. When you read them, however, you'll notice the public struggles with easy multiple-choice questions. How many American adults know the Bill of Rights is part of the Constitution? The American Revolution Center reports a dismal 57%, but the truth is far worse. Since there were only four response options, you would expect roughly 25% of the ignorant to guess the right answer by chance. And this is no isolated blind spot. One could look at these facts and conclude the public's historical and civic knowledge is no worse than its literacy. Yet such optimism overlooks a key point. Knowing half a subject's basic facts does not make you halfway proficient. If you know only half the letters in the alphabet, you are illiterate. Why? Because you lack knowledge of basic facts on which all reading depends. The same holds for the ABCs of history and civics. Not knowing the three branches of government isn't like not knowing Hamlet. It's like not knowing the letter H. If you don't know that the Civil War came after the Declaration of Independence, you don't understand American history. If you don't know which parties control the House and the Senate, you don't understand American politics. The average American high school graduate completes 4 years of history social studies coursework. 4 years. Ample time to learn the ABCs of history and civics by heart, to acquire the knowledge base, to discuss America's past, present, and future. Yet few adults possess this knowledge. If we owe everything we know about history and civics to history and civics classes, we owe next to nothing. Science. Few American adults know the ABCs of science. The General Social Survey provides the best evidence of their ignorance. In recent years, this survey has tested the public's knowledge of 12 elementary scientific facts. Adults correctly answer 60%. While this may seem low, it is a gross overstatement. These are true-false questions, so people should get 50% only guessing. Accounting for guessing, the public's scientific illiteracy is astonishing. Barely half of American adults know the Earth goes around the sun. Only 32% know atoms are bigger than electrons. Just 14% know that antibiotics don't kill viruses. Knowledge of evolution barely exceeds zero. Knowledge of the Big Bang is actually less than zero. Respondents would have done better flipping a coin. Guess corrected, the average respondent knows 4.6 answers. If adults learned everything they know about these 12 juvenile questions in high school science, they learned 1.4 answers per year. Educators can arguably blame the majority's disbelief in the Big Bang and evolution on Christian fundamentalism. Yet ignorance of the ABCs of science is non-denominational. Only 7% of adult Americans who deny the Bible's literal truth answered all 12 questions correctly. Given the ease of the questions, we shouldn't conclude Americans' knowledge of science is mediocre. We should conclude Americans' knowledge of science is virtually non-existent. Foreign languages. High school graduates average 2 years of foreign language coursework. What do adults have to show for it? The General Social Survey allows rather precise estimates. It asks respondents, can you speak a language other than English? How well do you speak that language? And is that a language you first learned as a child at home, in school, or is it one that you learned elsewhere? The results could scarcely be worse. Schools make virtually no one fluent in a foreign language. Only 0.7% claim to have learned a foreign language very well in school. Another 1.7% claim to have learned a foreign language well in school. Since these are self-reports, true linguistic competence must be even worse. The hard truth, if you didn't acquire fluency in the home, you almost certainly don't have it. Classroom sitting is easily measured and plainly massive. In our society, virtually everyone sits in school for over a decade. Yet this hardly shows students' learning or retention is massive. Adult knowledge is a superior measure. While people obviously learn outside of school, their total knowledge puts a ceiling on what they learned inside of school. The results are disheartening. Most Americans possess basic literacy and numeracy, but only 13% are proficient. For history, civics, science, and foreign language, few Americans grasp the ABCs. The claim that schools teach these subjects is an overstatement. Schools only teach of these subjects. After years of exposure, American adults know history, civics, science, and foreign languages exist. That's about it. American staggering ignorance may not be a death blow for human capital purism, but it is an awkward fact. If we learn so little in school, why do employers so heavily reward education? The simplest response is that employers, like teachers, grade on a curve. Intermediate literacy and numeracy horrify intellectuals. From an employer's point of view, however, intermediate is way better than basic or below basic. The main weakness with this response, even adults who did well in school usually lack basic knowledge of history, civics, science, and foreign language. Yet employers still hold failing grades in these subjects against you. If you fail Spanish, you don't finish high school. You can't go to college, and the labor market punishes you, even though most BAs are equally monolingual. How can human capital purists explain that? The relevance of relevance. Youths spend years studying subjects adults rarely use on the job. Adults are amazingly ignorant about subjects they studied since childhood. Is there any way to square these facts with the popular assumption that employers value your education solely because they value your learning? There is. Maybe course catalogs and standardized tests fail to capture most of what students learn. When students challenge the relevance of their lessons, teachers often reply, "I teach you how to think, not what to think." Teachers could dismiss adult ignorance in roughly the same way. They learned how to think, not what to think. So what if most students won't use European history or the periodic table on the job? Relevance is irrelevant. As long as students learn something, they tacitly acquire marketable skills en passant. If these teachers are right, defenders of education can draw a line in the sand. The prevalence of useless subjects and scarcity of measured learning is an illusion. The fact that you neither use nor remember your coursework in history and science does not make your coursework a waste of time. A history class can teach critical thinking. A science class can teach logic. Thinking, all thinking, builds mental muscles. The bigger students' mental muscles, the better they'll be at whatever job they eventually land. Comforting claims. They soothe teachers' consciences and quiet our self-doubt, but are they true or merely wishful thinking? Can believers in the power of learning how to think back up teachers' boasts with hard evidence? For the most part, no. Educational psychologists who specialize in transfer of learning have measured the hidden intellectual benefits of education for over a century. Their chief discovery? Education is narrow. As a rule, students learn only the material you specifically teach them, if you're lucky. In the words of educational psychologists Perkins and Salomon, besides just plain forgetting, people commonly fail to marshal what they know effectively in situations outside the classroom or in other classes in different disciplines. The bridge from school to beyond, or from this subject to that other, is a bridge too far. Many experiments study transfer of learning under seemingly ideal conditions. Researchers teach subjects how to answer question A. Then they immediately ask their subjects question B, which can be handily solved using the same approach as question A. Unless A and B look alike on the surface, or subjects get a heavy-handed hint to apply the same approach, learning how to solve question A rarely helps subjects answer question B. One classic experiment teaches subjects how to solve a military puzzle, then tests whether subjects apply what they learned to solve a medical puzzle. The military puzzle. A general wishes to capture a fortress located in the center of a country. There are many roads radiating outward from the fortress. All have been mined so that while small groups of men can pass over the roads safely, any large force will detonate the mines. A full-scale direct attack is therefore impossible. The general's solution is to divide his army into small groups, send each group to the head of a different road, and have the groups converge simultaneously on the fortress. The medical puzzle. Suppose you are a doctor faced with a patient who has a malignant tumor in his stomach. It is impossible to operate on the patient, but unless the tumor is destroyed, the patient will die. There is a kind of ray that can be used to destroy the tumor. If the rays reach the tumor all at once at a sufficiently high intensity, the tumor will be destroyed. Unfortunately, at this intensity, the healthy tissue that the rays pass through on the way to the tumor will also be destroyed. At lower intensities, the rays are harmless to healthy tissue, but they will not affect the tumor either. What type of procedure might be used to destroy the tumor with the rays and at the same time avoid destroying the healthy tissue? The connection? There is an analogous convergence solution to the radiation problem. The doctor could direct multiple low-intensity rays toward the tumor simultaneously from different directions so that the healthy tissue will be left unharmed, but the effects of the low-intensity rays will summate and destroy the tumor. Since subjects hear these two stories back-to-back, you might think almost everyone would leap to the convergence solution for the medical problem. They don't. A typical success rate is 30%. Since about 10% of subjects who don't hear the military problem offer the convergence solution, only 1 in 5 subjects transferred what they learned. To reach a high, roughly 75% success rate, you need to teach subjects the first story, then bluntly tell them to use the first story to solve the second. To repeat, such experiments measure how humans learn how to think under ideal conditions. Teach A, immediately ask B, then see if subjects use A to solve B. Researchers are leading the witness. As psychologist Douglas Detterman remarks, teaching the principle in close association with testing transfer is not very different from telling subjects they should use the principle just taught. Telling subjects to use a principle is not transfer. It is following instructions. Under less promising conditions, transfer is predictably even worse. Making the surface features of A and B less similar impedes transfer. Adding a time delay between teaching A and testing B impedes transfer. Teaching A, then teaching an irrelevant distractor problem, then testing B impedes transfer. Teaching A in a classroom, then testing B in the real world impedes transfer. Having one person teach A and another person test B impedes transfer. To apply schoolwork in the real world, you must normally overcome each and every one of these hurdles. You must see through surface features to underlying structure. You must select the few relevant lessons and ignore the rest. You must remember relevant lessons years or decades after encountering them. You must apply what you learned in a non-academic location without your original teacher or any teacher to hold your hand. No wonder even transfer optimists like Robert Haskell lament, "Despite the importance of transfer of learning, research findings over the past 9 decades clearly show that as individuals and as educational institutions, we have failed to achieve transfer of learning on any significant level." You might protest that transfer experiments are too artificial or superficial to show much about real-world education. If each lesson microscopically honed your thinking skills, the total effect of education on general thinking skills could still be large. Researchers generally find, for example, that college attendance boosts scores on tests of critical thinking. But this is a hollow victory. Researchers also generally find that education fails to durably improve critical thinking outside the classroom. The most impressive study of the effect of education on thinking skills collected a sample of first-year high school students, fourth-year high school students, first-year college students, fourth-year college students, first-year graduate students, and fourth-year graduate students. The researcher then orally tested their informal reasoning on issues like, does violence on television significantly increase the likelihood of violence in real life? And would a proposed law in Massachusetts requiring a 5-cent deposit on bottles and cans significantly reduce litter? By design, there were no right or wrong answers. The point of the test was to measure the quality of subjects' reasoning on issues that permitted elaborate arguments on both sides of the case, led to divided opinions, proved accessible even to the first-year high school group, and did not depend for their analysis on background knowledge that varied greatly across the subject population. Judges listened to recordings of the original responses, counting A, number of sentences, B, number of lines of argument, C, number of objections considered, and D, how many times the experimenter had to remind the subject to stay on topic. The experimenter also asked subjects to explain the connection between one of their arguments and their conclusion. Judges graded the quality of these explanations as well as overall quality of reasoning. The measured effect of education on informal reasoning, though positive, was tiny. Fourth-year high school students were slightly better than first-year high school students. Fourth-year college students were no better than first-year college students. Fourth-year graduate students were barely better than first-year graduate students. Respondents with more educational credentials definitely get higher scores. The point is that students barely improve between their first and fourth years of study. While people with better reasoning skills do complete more education, their reasoning skills are better at the outset. If education seriously showed students how to think, 3 additional years of study would sharply amplify their initial advantage. Yet students' scores barely budge. Other evidence is equally disappointing. One researcher tested several hundred Arizona State University students' ability to apply statistical and methodological concepts to reasoning about everyday life events. How, for example, would subjects assess the claim that students should eat more nutritiously because the majority of students needing psychological counseling had poor dietary habits? Would subjects realize psychological problems might cause poor dietary habits, rather than the other way around? Would they feel the need for experimental evidence? No. In the author's words, "The results were shocking. Of the several hundred students tested, many of whom had taken more than 6 years of laboratory science in high school and college and advanced mathematics through calculus, almost none demonstrated even a semblance of acceptable methodological reasoning about everyday life events described in ordinary newspaper and magazine articles. The overwhelming majority of responses received a score of 0. Fewer than 1% obtained the score of 2, that corresponded to a good scientific response. Totally ignoring the need for comparison groups and control of third variables, subjects responded to the diet example with statements such as, "It can't hurt to eat well." The point is not merely that college students are bad at reasoning about everyday events. The point is that college students are bad at reasoning about everyday events despite years of coursework in science and math. Believers in learning how to learn should expect students who study science to absorb the scientific method, then habitually use that fruitful method to analyze the world. This scarcely occurs. By and large, college science teaches students what to think about topics on the syllabus, not how to think about the world. Counterexamples do exist, but compared to teachers' high hopes, effects are modest, narrow, and often only in one direction. One experiment randomly taught one of two structurally equivalent topics, A, the algebra of arithmetic progression, or B, the physics of constant acceleration. Researchers then asked algebra students to solve the physics problems and physics students to solve the algebra problems. Only 10% of the physics students used what they learned to solve the algebra problems, but a remarkable 72% of the algebra students used what they learned to solve the physics problems. Applying abstract math to concrete physics comes much more naturally than generalizing from concrete physics to abstract math. More impressively, studying statistics enhances statistical reasoning on real-life questions outside the classroom. One research team phoned 193 male introductory statistics students from the University of Michigan in their homes. Interviewers withheld the fact that they were targeting statistics students. Half the subjects were interviewed in the semester's first week, the rest were interviewed in the semester's last week. The official purpose of the phone call was to solicit students' opinions about sports. The true purpose was to see if statistics students would spontaneously apply their lessons to a novel topic, sports, in a non-academic setting, their homes. Researchers recorded the conversations, measuring the presence and quality of statistical reasoning. A semester of statistics mattered, but the effect was uneven. Students substantially improved on 2 out of 4 statistically relevant questions. Why does the rookie of the year usually perform worse in his second year? At the beginning of the semester, only 16% gave a statistical answer. At the end of the semester, 37% did so. Why are top batting averages higher after 2 weeks of play than at the end of the season? At the beginning of the semester, 50% gave a statistical answer. At the end, 70% did so. The quality of statistical reasoning on these two questions improved as well. On the other two statistically relevant questions, however, the experimenters were surprised to find no gain. Compared to most experiments, the sports statistics study found impressive transfer of learning. Compared to teachers' aspirations, however, the results are a letdown. The experimenters deliberately wrote easy questions, and the participants were students at one of the most elite universities in the country. Yet statistical reasoning improved on only half the questions, and most students did not improve. Furthermore, the researchers measured statistical learning at its peak the final week of the class.